Hey, I'm Zach, and one day I'm going to make movies, but right now I'm young, dumb, and not nearly as good-looking as my co-hosts. So with the help of...
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
I'm Steven.
I'm going to learn what makes a movie great by watching all the classics I have skipped over. So pop the corn and turn your cell phone to silent, because it's time for a new episode of Zach on Film. It's cold here in the Major Spoilers headquarters, but it was a hot day in Spike Lee's 1989, Do the Right Thing. And that's what we're talking this week on Zach on Film.
All right, Zach. This is a tough one.
Yeah.
This is probably different. I mean, the last two movies that we've done, Rodrigo, are coming-of-age movies, right?
Right.
This, to an extent, is a coming-of-age in a sense that it is an awakening moment for a lot of people. Mm. Particularly movie audiences who saw this in 1989. But it is quite a bit different than the teenage comedy.
Oh, yeah.
So, Zach, you've had some time to watch this.
Yeah.
You've had some time to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully.
That's what I've pretty much been doing the last couple of days.
Give us a rundown of Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, and then we'll start talking about themes and issues that come out of this movie.
All right. So, a broad overview of what Do the Right Thing is. It's summer in Brooklyn. It's going to be one of the hottest days of the year. It takes place over the course of one singular day. And it's essentially about the different races living in this Brooklyn neighborhood and how they interact. And it's centered around Sal's famous pizzeria and how the different characters interact. And that's kind of a lot of deals with racism, bigotry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's kind of hard to.
No, I mean, that's
it.
I mean, it's
a
movie about race relations and how different people view each other.
Yeah.
And I forget the a book. I remember reading this book when I was much younger. But essentially, in this book that I read, you're putting rats in the cage. And in this cage, if you have a certain number of rats, the rats kind of leave each other alone and they don't get into arguments too many times. But then the more rats you put in and the more tighter that space becomes, suddenly they start turning on each other and aggressions go up and all of these, you know, weird psychological things start to happening when you're packed into a compact space. I don't know about you, but when I get hot, I get irritable.
Yeah.
And when you've got a lot of people packed into a small space, like New York City, Brooklyn, I can just imagine on a hot day, tempers are flaring, people are already testy at one another, and then you throw in the race issue, and suddenly things are going to explode. Am I right, Rodrigo, on this?
Oh, sure.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to go a little bit deeper into that.
No, he's agreeing with you.
So... then young Zach.
Yeah.
Tell us about some of the themes. What are some messages that Spike Lee is trying to get across? I mean, we see a lot, we see a lot of continual discussion about race. We have people in the neighborhood who don't like Mookie, played by Spike Lee, working for Sal's famous pizzeria because Sal is a white guy and a bigot, and his sons, Pico and,
Pino.
Are, to varying degrees, bigots as well, racists as well. We get a lot of colorful characters in this world. Some of them played up straight for laughs. Some of them played up very seriously. Ultimately, though, things explode and a fight breaks out, leading to the death of Radio Raheem, one of the, I wouldn't say central characters, but he does become a central focus at the end of the movie, where he's killed by a white police, and fighting breaks out, and they burn the pizzeria down.
Yeah,
that's, you know, a very broad overview of what's going on here.
Yeah.
Well, it's appropriate, though. It's,
yeah.
Yeah.
So, where do you want to start, Matthew?
Well, for me, I think the obvious place to start is with that central conceit, that central problem of, you know, they have that long sequence of everybody yelling the other group's racial stereotypes at them. Mm-hmm. And then Samuel L. Jackson telling everybody, hold the F word up.
You know, that happens.
Happens about
midway, right?
Just right before midway.
Yeah.
In the movie.
Yeah.
Which I think is kind of interesting, because at that point, when that happens, which is a very, I think, powerful moment where everybody's just screaming these epitaphs at one another.
Yeah. And it's extended too. It's not like a quick sequence.
No,
it is just waha.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think what's most interesting about that is it says that everybody, that really in this film, nobody is on the right, right? There's not one person who is a, and we'll say, quote unquote, good character here, right? Everybody has some fault. And in this case, the racism is the fault that all of them have. Even
the Korean
store owner, who has very little playtime in the movie, gets to, you know, say, you know, what he's thinking inside about people that he's encountering every single day.
Right. Everybody in the movie comes in with their expectations and their bias.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes right down to it, this is one of my favorite Spike Lee joints, because there is a definite perspective, and the filmmaker is clearly coming out and saying, excuse me, y'all are idiots. But more importantly, he's saying that everybody has this same idiocy, and all of the characters that we see in here play into it in one way or another. And when things finally explode, you know, it's entirely those biases that cause the bad things to happen. But those same biases eventually lead to the kind of sort of maybe kind of upbeat, not quite upbeat ending. If you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. Each of the characters that Spike Lee puts into this movie are there for a very specific reason.
Yes.
And they represent different groups and thoughts and ideologies of people.
Yeah.
Do you want to give us a breakdown? Do you want to take a look at Sal first, the owner of the pizzeria?
Salvatore.
And what he represents?
Sal, to me, was probably one of the more my favorite character in the movie, just for how he's portrayed throughout. Sal is the owner of his own pizzeria, and he's, because it's kind of like everyone has a moment where you think, oh, they're okay, and then another moment they're just like a complete dirtbag the entire time.
Right.
And so Sal has been in his own shop for 25 years, and even his son comes to him out the middle of the movie. He said, why are we here? They don't want us here. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't be here. We should be in our neighborhood. And Sal's like, no, this is my shop. I've been here for 25 years. I've fed these kids food. They've been raised on my pizza, and that's something I'm proud of. But then when Buggin' Out comes, he'll get really upset at him for wanting different people up on his wall of fame. And then when Radio Raheem comes in blasting his music, Sal's perspective completely twists, and he gets very upset. He's an interesting character.
Rodrigo, you want to go a little bit further on the Sal character?
Yeah, I think that, you know, Sal is also in a lot of ways, definitely seen by the characters as kind of the establishment.
Right.
Yeah.
Because he owns the establishement in town, right?
Exactly.
Or in that block, or two blocks.
He employs, you know, out of all the characters that we meet, he employs three characters that are pretty important. But most importantly, he employs the main character. He employs Mookie. And his friends, you know, give him crap for working for Sal, because Sal is a white guy in a black neighborhood, you know, but probably more importantly, an Italian guy in a black neighborhood, because his Italianness is actually brought up constantly and is important enough that, you know, maybe it needs to be more specified than necessarily the fact that he's white. But to a large degree, it goes back and forth between whether it matters or not. But yeah, I mean, he monetarily is fairly secure. The neighborhood relies on him. So he is he's kind of a pillar of that society, and which makes him something that is, it puts him in a position where others can rebel against him, and where he can lay down rules and enforce his authority.
Right.
As well.
I think from my perspective, we look at Sal as someone who is the racist who doesn't realize he's racist, right? But through his actions, he's saying, hey, look how I've treated these people in the neighborhood. And over 25 years, this neighborhood becomes predominantly black. Look at how I've treated these people so kindly. Me, the great white grace for this neighborhood. Look at what I do to these people. And it's only through his actions as they build and build and build and build and build that finally at the end, when he breaks out the bat and starts beating Radio Raheem's radio and starts using the N-word constantly, do we really see that come to the surface, fully come to the surface? And I think that there is a large part of America that fits into that Sal category.
Well, if you look at Sal, and, you know, I'm not going to make an excuse for anybody in this movie. I am myself Caucasian. So,
what?
You know, that gives me a bias that I look at. But if you look at what Sal actually says, and when the argument starts, when Giancarlo Esposito is up in his face, Sal says, I'm bugging proud out. Of my Italian. Yeah, bugging out. I'm proud of my Italian heritage. This is my wall. I put my people on that wall.
Right.
That statement, up to the end of that statement, that's a perfectly legitimate statement to make. Up until the point when, again, he starts bashing the people. But when you actually, when you take the whole situation, that whole day into account, Sal is no more or no less guilty of the racism that is all over this movie.
No, but if you're talking about, you know, overall racism and really everyone's racist views throughout this movie, Sal is certainly that represents one portion of America, which is quite a bit different than Pino, his oldest son, who is very racist. And he represents, you know, the aggressive, I don't want to say white supremacist, but the aggressive racist out here who believes in class separation, who says we need to be in our neighborhood, they need to be in their neighborhood, and we need to do this for us.
Who says, you know, the black people that I look up to and admire are not actually black.
Right.
Because that's a conflict.
Right. Exactly. And when you look at that, though, you can see where Pino gets that from his dad. His dad saying, I put Italian people on the wall in my Italian restaurant. You can see where what Sal believes has shaped Pino into the utter bastard that he ends up being throughout this film.
Yeah.
Throwing bombs.
It is a great example when you look at Pino and Vito.
Right.
Of the same upbringing in an angry person and the same upbringing in a kind of a bashful person gives you two drastically different people.
Well, but
one of which is a raging bastard and the other one, which is, you know, a really kind of bashful person.
Right. And so Vito's character, again, as I see this, is someone who is afraid to stand up to the racist, right?
Yeah.
Vito is afraid to stand up to his brother, the racist, because he gets along with pretty much everyone in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. You never see him having a conflict with one another. He's the only, maybe Sal to an extent, but he's the only one that tries to have conversations with Mookie to say, hey, you know, let's try to work this out at some point. So he is somebody that's trying to be neutral, but he also is at fault in this movie because he won't stand up to his brother. He won't say, this is wrong, you're wrong. And again, as a reflection on society, there are a number of people that still will do that. If they see something being derogatory to someone else, class, race, whatever, nobody steps up. And so Vito then represents that group of people.
It's not that he won't.
He doesn't fight back.
He won't stand up to him. He actually defends Pino when Mookie and him walk down to the radio station.
Right.
And Mookie's saying, well, why don't you just hit him?
Right.
Because you don't really believe what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
But Vito's like, oh, you just don't know my brother. If you live with him, then you just don't understand why he thinks this.
Right. And I think that there are some really, really savvy choices in the filmmaking itself. And I think the biggest, and for me, the most immediately wonderful choice is the Bedford Stuy neighborhood that this takes place in.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, I've been in that neighborhood and you walk from street to street and you hear that, you know, when I was there, which was God.
This has been about the same time period.
Yeah.
Yeah. You would hear
the
language on the street would change from block to block.
Right.
Now, I know for a fact that I have been in Boys High School in Bedford Stuy, mm-hmm. because it's a gorgeous, gorgeous building. And if I understand this, you know, the locations in the film, it's like maybe, I don't know, the four blocks is away somewhere.
It's two blocks is where it takes is place it? In. That, yeah. I mean, of course, there's a more expanded place because we don't know where Tina lives. We don't expect right. her to live within that same block.
Right.
But most of the stuff takes place within that two blocks of right. Sal's. Mm-hmm.
And it's also, you know, it's the location. There were huge riots in the 60s oh, yeah. in Bedford Stuy.
Right.
So when you go into this movie, if you don't know anything about the area, it's clear what's going on. If you have right. a historical perspective, you can actually see what's coming in this film. And that mm-hmm. to me is, you know, especially well, for a young filmmaker, that's fascinating.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
To see how he builds that up.
And especially the fact that Radio Raheem has choked to death, because that's mm-hmm. actually something that happened, what, a couple of years before in and around the same area where he was somebody was choked out by the police and killed. So, yeah, there's a lot of that stuff that, you know, 30 years later mm-hmm. or 20 years, however long it's been.
Even just a couple years.
Yeah, that mm-hmm. we don't remember those things. What is bugging out? If we've talked about Sal, Pino, and Vito, what does mm-hmm. bugging out represent then, Zach?
Bugging out is, I believe, kind of a representation of the Malcolm X
mm-hmm.
Standpoint of how to deal with race relations.
Mm-hmm.
More of a violent action is possible
mm-hmm.
kind of standpoint.
Instigator.
Yeah, that'd be a good mm-hmm. word.
He's not necessarily an antagonist, because I don't feel like he's the villain.
No,
but he is the instigator of a lot of the conflict.
Well, he's certainly the instigator of the central conflict.
Yeah, right. Completely.
Yeah, but you're right. He would be representing that aggressive, more militant standpoint.
By any
yeah.
means necessary.
Yeah, by any means necessary. Yeah. We'll come back around to Martin and Malcolm at the end, because, you know, that plays a big role in the overall message that's been sent out, or the conflicting messages that go out. What about Radio Raheem?
Are you asking me?
Yes. You are the one. You are the one that's being questioned.
You are the one learning.
You are the one.
You are the one on film.
Yay!
It's not Fat Man on film.
Radio Raheem's the way I saw it in opposite of bugging out, and he seemed to take a more somewhat peaceful approach, especially if you look at his part when he when him and Mookie meet in the middle of the street, and he's heading to Sal, he does a little love mm-hmm. hate thing, and he's talking about how love,
if I love you I love you, if I hate you I hate you,
right,
and it depends on your actions, or you're going to be dependent upon my actions, essentially is what it
well yeah to. And he said it, well, in that it's well, he said the right hand of love conquered the left right hand of hate. So mm-hmm. I mean, that in that perspective, it he was definitely tense throughout, but he seemed somewhat peaceful in certain points.
Yeah, the left hand right hand thing is from Night of the Hunter,
right? Yeah.
Anybody, maybe Rodrigo, take a look at the boombox as a phallic symbol.
Phallic?
I wouldn't say phallic, but it's definitely Radio Raheem establishes his supremacy through his boombox.
Right.
It's his item of power for sure.
And yeah, and we only see Radio Raheem lose it two times. Literally, like, lose the boombox and lose control two times. One at the Korean neighborhood when he's or in the store. Well, actually, mm-hmm. I don't know. They're Koreans, right?
Yeah, they're Koreans.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sunny. Yeah.
Where his boombox runs out of batteries and he can't communicate to them that he needs more batteries.
Yeah.
And then later on when his boombox gets smashed.
Right, but so again in this movie there aren't a lot of strong female characters. And even Spike Lee will say that, yes, even while I'm filming this, I was realizing that there are female characters here, but they're not as strong as they could be.
Yeah.
But instead, what we get is males fighting against one another and bashing one another over just male things, guy things. Mm-hmm. And so when you see Radio Raheem with his giant boombox, he is establishing, I am supreme. I am the biggest on the block. Mm-hmm. And it even gets to the point where they have the boombox duel.
Yeah.
Now, Matthew and I, probably remember boombox fights. I don't know if Rodrigo remembers boombox fights.
No, we had Discman.
Did you ever have car stereo battles?
Yeah, we did. I actually had a friend who had a really, really good stereo for his car. And it's actually just because he had an old car. None of us had a lot of money, but he had a car that just happened to have been built with a really good stereo. And there would be kids that were blasting music, and it was usually like really crappy rap. And he would like blast like Rock and Roll Part 2.
Nice.
Or something like deliberately that he thought they would like just or was like really stupid. You, like that's around when
banjos.
Yeah, when Barbie Girl came out, he would like blast that. And it would just like drown the parking lot.
Because he's trying to do what? He's trying to exert his dominance over everyone else in the neighborhood, right? Or everyone else in the parking lot. Same way with Radio Raheem. Yeah, he gets to the point where he
was a hipster, so he was ironically
yes.
exerting his dominance over everyone.
But in the movie, Radio Raheem comes up with the Puerto Rican group that's sitting on the stoop, and he's like, turn that down. And they're like, nope. And he's got a smaller boombox, and he turns it up. And Radio Raheem continues to turn his up, and they, you know, Radio Raheem establishes that he is the most dominant, most powerful in the neighborhood because he's got the biggest, most powerful boombox. And everyone else acquiesces. You know, they eventually turn the music down and let him go on his way.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of domination, you know, trying to establish dominance over other people, other groups throughout this story. What about then when we get to the mayor? What does he represent in this world?
The mayor represents kind of, I don't know, the old way, kind of?
Probably.
Yeah, the old way of doing doing things.
And to an extent, the Greek chorus, the three guys.
Okay, yeah.
You know, those who want to turn away from what's going on through alcohol and getting drunk.
Yeah.
Now, granted, this is on a Saturday, so this may not be a typical week or a typical day in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
But certainly the mayor becoming drunk or representing that aspect of people who would rather just medicate that way to forget or to ignore, it plays a role. I guess also with Sal, if you think about Sal's relationship with the mayor comes in, nobody wants him here. So what does Sal do? He gives him money to go away. He pays Mookie to go away. He pays Smiley to go away.
He pays the mayor to sweep.
To go away.
Get out of sight, out of mind. Out front.
Out front. Out of sight, out of mind. Smiley the same way. Out of sight, out of mind. Mookie, give him the money at the end. Go away. So, again, another kind of theme of the character is if I throw enough money at it, it will go away. My problem will go away.
Well, that's his power.
Right.
That's the power that he has that other people don't. I think with the mayor also, to me, is kind of the representation of the character who's too old to fight any longer. Or not necessarily too old to fight, but old enough that maybe he doesn't see the point in the fight.
Yeah.
Nobody mess with the mayor. Well, the mayor don't bother nobody. Nobody bother the mayor but you. He's kind of retreated into his bottle. And that's his thing, and he's fine, and he loves everybody.
I have this read of the mayor that he actually represents, like, male wisdom. Especially when you pair him up with, and literally when they pair him up with Mother Sister as kind of that female wisdom. And it's like, he's old. He rescues a kid. You see that he's a good person. He is the one who tells you, who says out loud the title of the movie to Mookie, who then ultimately you might say fail to carry out what he says. Yep. You know, always do the right thing.
Is that it?
His wisdom. That's it.
That's it. All right. Got it. I'm gone.
His wisdom, the wisdom that men around him don't have is basically don't fight. Don't. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's no reason to upset people. There's no reason to declare your dominance. If something is problematic, just throw away and come back later.
So then
and,
if
and
we're,
things will be better.
If we're looking at Buggin' Out as the Malcolm X, does the mayor then represent Martin Luther?
No. I actually think that the dichotomy, the strongest dichotomy in this movie is Buggin' Out and Jade. And the main reason for that is that they are both close to Mookie, who is ultimately the one who has to make that choice. You know, Jade tells him, get a job, do the thing, work for Sal, make money, like do everything that you're supposed to be doing the best way possible. Which is what Martin Luther King was saying is, you know, there's no reason to fight. If you show people that you are a good person, if you show people that you are a person like them, if you show people love and respect, they will show you love and respect. And when Jade comes down from her apartment and walks around, everybody loves her. You can see that. You know, even like she has a direct conversation with Buggin' Out. Buggin' Out kind of weirdly berates her, and she just completely deflects him, disarms him, and in the end, they're okay with each other.
If you look at DeMayer's other big scene when he's not saving, you know, the kid from dying, DeMayer acts twice to avoid conflict. One, to keep Sal from getting choked out, and DeMayer actually physically acts to get Sal out of the way of being killed. Sal is trying to protect his pizza parlor, and DeMayer takes him out of the way, saves his life, and it, you know, it feels like he's doing it to because he knows that Sal doesn't realize that it's not worth dying for. He is the one who is not necessarily, he is avoiding conflict. Even when he's getting drunk and sitting on the porch, he's avoiding conflict. And that's a good thing in some places, but it's also the thing that makes him almost, you know, the town joke, the town drunk. By avoiding that conflict, he hasn't fought at times when maybe he should have.
What about the three men? I call them the Greek chorus. Zach, do you know what a Greek chorus is?
Not specifically. I've heard of it. I think I've seen it on TV tropes before.
Zach or I'm sorry, Matthew or Rodrigo.
I can take it.
Go ahead, Rodrigo.
TV tropes. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
So in ancient Greek theater, it was very structured. It very quickly became a very structured thing. And one of the conceits of it was the chorus, which explained to you, basically gave you direct exposition, sometimes commented on what was going on so that the audience would know which direction you were supposed to be feeling. If somebody did something violent, the Greek chorus would be like, oh, this was a great deed. And you're like, oh, okay. So I'm not supposed to be like mad at that guy for killing his brother. He was supposed to kill his brother. Okay, cool. You see the chorus. It disappeared for a while, came back, disappears, comes back. It has, you know, the what we think of as the narrator has its roots in the Greek chorus. What we think of as three girls from Little Shop of Horrors have is, which by the way is the link there, because one of the girls from Little Shop of Horrors then goes on to marry one of the guys from Do the Right Thing. Boom. And then that's when Martin happens. But so the Greek chorus comments on the action and usually tells you what is going on and how you should feel about it. These guys that Stephen is referring to don't exactly I don't think that you should take their opinion necessarily on how to feel about things, but they have that role of kind of commenting and bringing everything that's going on together and then proceeding to largely make fun of each other.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, do the kids also serve in that role? The Martin Lawrence and the I forget the girl. I've seen her somewhere else before, too. But, you know, they're running around commenting from their perspective, a different age group perspective. So do they come at that also fulfilling that same role?
I don't know. I think that that's actually a good point, that the three layabouts and the kids are kind of the same group of characters, just at different ages. And you can see that the kids are a lot more literally active, but also a lot more aggressive and confrontational. Whereas the old guys are equally, I guess, like, vitriolic. They're equally negative, but have kind of resigned themselves to just sitting on their street corner and not doing anything about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Until the very end, where everybody gets up and fights.
Right, right. Well, but, you know, they do end up showing restraint, because at the one point, the one with the glasses is saying, hey, we got to go take care of those Koreans. And he's been complaining about them throughout the whole movie. And then at the last moment, when Sal's is burning down, he turns and says, now it's time to take out the Koreans. Yeah. And the Koreans are like, no, 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 no. We're the same. You know, we're going through these exact same things. Don't take this out on me. And then they restrain themselves and pull back.
Mm-hmm.
So then what then? We're having some issues with Matthew connecting. I'm sure he wants to jump in on this. You've already established, Rodrigo, that Jade then becomes the Malcolm, or not the Malcolm, but the Martin character.
Mm-hmm. Martin Luther King.
Martin Luther King. What does Tina represent? And you've already talked about mother, sister as well. Mm-hmm. But what does Tina represent in society in this? Or maybe we should let Zach have a go at this first.
Sure.
I don't know. Let's just go to Rodrigo.
Let's go to Rodrigo with the highlight reel.
Yeah.
Zach's going to pass the wall.
I'm going to pass this one.
I don't think that Tina... I mean, I think you can say that she does. You can probably read her in a handful of ways. But honestly, I think that Tina is very much a person, more so than any sort of allegorical character. She is specifically there for Mookie. She represents, character-wise, Mookie's past,
mm-hmm.
potentially his future, because he's still together with her. And she is this entity that kind of exists outside of the movie for all intents and purposes. You know, she orders a pizza to pull him out of it, and briefly he does not exist in Bed-Stuy
for
that amount of time. You see him as a lover and as a different person, and then he goes back to it.
Right.
And, you know, she's not there when everything goes down either. I mean, she is basically absent.
Right. Yeah, and that's why
the movie itself.
And you get the impression, and that's why we were talking earlier about how wide does this story take place. You get the feeling that she is several blocks away.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the delivery area of Sal's Pizza is, but she is purposefully not part of this group or this mm-hmm. dynamic. This is something that is, to an extent, foreign to Mookie, because it's not in his neighborhood. It's not in his place of comfort, I guess, his home.
Yeah.
And so we kind of get into that. Did you have anything you wanted to add, Matthew, about Tina, now that you're back on with us?
Rosie Perez, always adorable.
Yes, yes, she is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
More popular, well, this was her first movie, right?
Yes.
More popular from Do the Right Thing or more popular from White Men Can't Jump?
Ooh, that's tough. I like this character more, but I think probably White Men Can't Jump had more eyes on it.
Yeah. Senior Love Daddy. What does he represent in this film?
Samuel L. Jackson.
Anyone? Anyone?
Voice of Reason?
Okay.
Kind of thing?
Well,
you think so?
I don't know about reason. Maybe restraint would be a better way to look at it.
Okay.
Because he's not necessarily that wise character. He's just a character who's like, hey, now wait a minute. I think that his bias is there as well, but I don't know if I would call him reason. Reason is probably the name.
I think Senior Love Daddy is, and it's great to even have to refer to a character by that name.
Isn't that awesome?
Yeah, Mr. Senior Love Daddy is actually the chapter breaks.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm.
When we're getting ready to go in a new direction, he pops up either commenting on what just happened or he prefaces it. You know, he is the first thing we hear at the beginning. It's going to be a hot one today. He is the last thing we hear at the end when he, you know, dedicates the last song to Radio Raheem. And then throughout, you know, when things get really intense and the movie's about to go in a new direction, to either break that intensity or to increase it in a separate way, yeah, that's when Love Daddy comes in.
Yeah, he's clearly the break right in the mm-hmm. middle when he does the roll call.
Oh, man.
Yep.
As far as writing goes, every word that Spike Lee wrote in this film, I think is wonderful. Mm-hmm. And Roll Call is probably one of my favorite, just long stringing together of names.
Oh, yeah.
It just flows. And with Samuel L. Jackson, it just flows and sounds so wonderful. But even, you know, even conversations between DeMayer and
Mother Sister
are just beautiful, wonderful, yeah. Little, you know, love happening. When Mookie and his sister Jade are having their conversations, there's meaning behind that. Also probably helps that yeah, Spike Lee and siblings. Jade are actually siblings, yes.
When Vito and Pino are fighting.
Yeah, I mean,
there's
yeah.
still there's a lyrical nature yes. to.
Yes, there really is. So I've held back on talking about the Mookie character.
Yeah.
And I find this interesting because it seems that Spike Lee is playing a character that he tends to dismiss the most in many of the other things that he says or talks about or writes about.
Oh, what's that? I mean, I guess we can talk about it, but
he is not a father. I mean, he basically abandons his kid.
Yeah.
Doesn't see the kid for weeks at a time. He's only in it for the money. He's only in it for, you know, we don't hear him talking about got to buy the Nikes or whatever, but he certainly fits into the fashion sense mm-hmm. of this world and this age group. He represents that group that I think Bill Cosby says, pull up your pants and, you know, be responsible. And Mookie is anything but responsible in this movie. And I find that fascinating. Rodrigo?
I can see that. I think that...
I mean, and when we talk female characters, I mean, the females are always telling him what to do. Mookie, from Tina, Mookie, where are you? You're never around. You're never the father. Take mm-hmm. care of your kid. Raise your kid, Mookie. And then you get it from Jade. Mookie, get a job. Do the right thing. You know, be responsible, Mookie. Mm-hmm. So he's getting mm-hmm. it from that end. Sorry, Rodrigo. I didn't mean to interrupt there.
No. I think I can see that. You know, to me, Mookie is kind of I think he's set up as an everyman, and he's an everyman who has actually already made a lot of like the crucial choices that you would see in other movies.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Like in other movies, it'd be like, should I be a good father or should I like try to go off on my own? And by the beginning of the movie, he's already made that choice.
Yeah.
You know, he's barely involved at all in his kid's life. You know, he lives with his sister because he can't afford a place. You know, he's got things that maybe he's going to, but he's not. He's kind of given up on anything but being a pizza delivery guy. But I think that's also kind of not what's important. The most important thing is kind of that personal choice that he is going to end up making in the end of, you know, when all the chips fall, where he's going to stand.
Matthew.
He's kind of a blank slate, but not because he doesn't have opinions, but because he's so conflicted in terms of everybody's telling him what to do. And yeah. people are telling yeah, yeah. him, people are telling him different things. He's, I don't know if I'd call him a point of view character necessarily, but he's that character who is at the center of it, not because he's the most interesting or because he's the one who's integral to the plot. He is the one that all the others are trying to influence. When we say that Buggin' Out is an instigator, he's trying to instigate. He's trying to instigate him, you know, in Mookie into going with him, and you know, beating people up over their Jordans or whatever it is that he you know wants to go do. Everybody is trying to affect him, and he's not exactly the calm in the center, but he's sort of. He's slothful at the middle of everything, and everybody's telling him what to do, and he's not doing it, and you're not sure why necessarily. And then when everything blows up around him, you're just kind of like, wow, maybe he had kind of the right idea, only not.
I don't know.
Sense at all.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, because I don't think even at the end of the movie that he knows what to do.
Yeah.
Right? Because I think he's still looking out for himself. When he goes at the end of the movie and he says, Sal, I want my money, and Sal whips out and throws him $500 and says, look, Mookie, you're a rich man. You have more money, twice the money what he normally would get paid. Mookie says, no, I don't want that money. I don't want your extra money. And then in the end, he ends up taking it.
Yeah, he
ends up
taking it.
He ends up picking it up anyway and leaving. And it just, you know, it is a character that is in constant flux, in constant indecision, in constant doesn't know what's going on. But he says throughout the movie, gotta get paid, gotta get paid, gotta get paid. He's really only there for that yeah. money.
Yeah.
Which I don't know, is sad or not.
He knows what he knows.
No, I know. And so a lot of people then, and Zach has, I will give Zach credit. He's done his research because one of the things that Zach discovered in his research is what in regards to the title of the movie and Spike Lee's comments on that. I don't know what you're talking
well,
about.
I don't know what you're referring to.
So a lot of people go up to Spike Lee and say.
Oh, okay. That's what we're talking about. Oh.
God, Zach.
I just didn't know what you were referring to.
I try to throw the easiest softball.
I know. I just, sometimes we talk a lot of things. And when I was going through and I was reading, because obviously I finished this movie and my mind was just like on the wall, essentially.
That's how I was the first time I watched it.
And so I started going and I started reading reviews and essays that people had written on it. And they said, Spike Lee has said that only in regards to the ending with what Mookie does, only white people will come up and ask if Mookie did the right thing at the end. Mm-hmm. He said no one else will ever ask him that.
Which in itself, I think, is fascinating.
Yeah.
And it seems that, and Rodrigo, I think you made a comment earlier about white reviewers who thought that this movie was just going to cause all sorts of trouble.
Oh, that wasn't me. I think that was...
Oh, that was also Zach.
Oh, yeah, that was me.
Yeah, there was a lot of concern, right, Zach, about...
Yeah, and they said other people had gone through reviews after this for the movie, and only the white guys that were writing reviews were saying, oh, this movie is going to incite riots in the cities, and people are going to rise up in power, and that's why this movie should not be watched.
Yeah, or shouldn't even be released.
It shouldn't even be released, yeah.
Which, again, fascinating. Mm-hmm. Just fascinating. I mean, I remember watching this, and granted, I watched it on VHS. Would have had to have watched it on VHS.
Yeah.
And I probably was not... This movie came out what year?
89.
So this would have been probably during a break coming back from college in 89. Or maybe over the summer, I don't know.
Probably over the summer.
I would imagine that's probably when I saw it. But I remember getting the tape, renting it from the videotape store and watching this and going, I've heard so many things about this. I've got to watch this film. I've got to see what all the hullabaloo is about. Because, quite frankly, the closest I'd ever been to Spike Lee was watching his Mars, what's the Nike commercials that he did playing Mars. What was his last name?
Gotta be the Shoes.
Yeah, Gotta Be the Shoes. With
was it Mars Blackman?
Mars Blackman. Mars Blackman. And
oh, actually
Michael Jordan
a character, and she's got to have it
right.
Yep.
That's as close as I'd ever been to Spike Lee. And I, how could Spike Lee be this controversial? I got to see this movie, and just like you said, mind on the wall after watching this, going, "What have I just watched? This is really deep. There's a lot of stuff that I'm not understanding because I'm a white boy who lives out in the country, and just fascinating." And then a year later, I was dropped in the middle of Walt Disney World. Surrounded by everybody from everywhere. And it was very cool.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I think and this is going to come across as sounding facetious. So please bear with me before you laugh. It's okay to giggle, but understand what I'm trying to say. The thing and the reason that I went to see this movie was.
Did you go see it
in the
theater?
Summer. No. I didn't go to the movies. In the summer of 89. We've talked about my cousin who had a friend who worked at the video store down by the river.
Elwood?
Yeah, my cousin Elwood. He's awesome, by the way. But in any case, he's a Harley mechanic now. They had an adult section, and I was just 18. And I knew that this movie was something because there were two different parodies. There was Screw the Right Thing and Do the Tight Thing. And I'm like, they're referencing this movie, and there's two of them. I want to know what this movie's about. And this is, you know, as goofy as it is, that's why I went to check this movie out. And I'm glad I did, not just because of Rosie Perez, but, you know, kind of in that same experience, it's a very rural town. You know, we did not have anything, but people who lived on a farm, people who used to live on a farm, and people who, you know, bust in from the farm. And seeing this movie was just transformative. And eventually, I like to feel like this movie became one of the things that kind of reminded me, hey, not everybody comes from the same place, thinks the same things that you do.
Right.
But more importantly, everybody has that bias, and everybody has their own, their I almost said bull, their own BS. that comes with being who they are.
Right.
And I feel like doing the right thing for me is just remembering when my bias comes up. When I say, you're 12, Zach, that's me being old. That's my bias. And there's nothing wrong with being young and inexperienced, because inexperience is not the same as ignorance, as willful ignorance. So when I make fun of Zach for his inexperience, what I'm really mocking is someone, you know, my age who might be willfully ignorant and avoiding these experiences, which, you know, you get to the center of this movie. It's all about what is the right thing and how do you know if you're doing it?
Rodrigo, when did you first see this movie?
Probably like 2002 or something like that.
Okay.
I mean, I...
Were you living in Ohio at the time?
No, I was in college.
Oh, okay.
And it was like part of a series that they were doing, because they'd show, you know, important movies with some amount of frequency. So I watched this, and then I think afterwards I watched The Conversation, and Ooh. Then proceeded to watch The Conversation 15 more times, because every film professor loves The Conversation.
Yep.
And Steven's checking his list to see.
I knew it was on the list, but I just wanted to see if we had anything after.
We need to have that one, right, then thing. My dinner with Andre.
Yeah. So, yeah, I saw it. I mean, and, you know, I think because I was in college when I saw it. And so it wasn't like thematically, it wasn't a shock to the system, because I've had that before moving to a different country. Mm-hmm.
Right.
It was like, holy crap, everyone here is different. There is like a culture that is different from mine. And wait a minute, there are 15 cultures just in this neighborhood that are different from mine.
Yeah.
So that was very reinforced by Do the Right Thing. But I think formally it was kind of a shock, because it's a movie that kind of does whatever it wants.
Yeah.
And doesn't let any sort of, rules get in the way of the story that it wants to tell.
Yeah. I don't know if you would get away in, you know, today's movie making thing. It seems like people play a lot of really safe sort of focus groupy, let's not offend anybody things. I guess you would get away with that moment in the middle of the film where everybody starts yelling their particular, you know, and in a great big old round, everybody starts yelling, and then the next person comes up and yells too.
Do the Right Thing wasn't a major studio release, right?
Right.
So what we are often fed out here is major studio release. If you're in a bigger city, you're going to be able to go to the Metroplex that has, you know, 30 theaters, and everyone's going to be playing a different movie. And
Metroplex was one of the Autobots, wasn't he?
Yes, a giant theater that transforms into a aircraft carrier or something.
A giant theater that transforms into an abandoned theater.
No, so but it's in the 90s.
There's something, Zach, that yes, this was not a big film. And you're right, Matthew. Today, a big budget film probably could not get away with these kinds of things, themes, ideas, discussions, trying to be brought out. But if you live in a bigger city, Zach, and I hope someday you do, you'll be able to go down to the independent theater and you'll be able to see small films. I remember just, you know, many times people get tired of me saying this. I've lived in Atlanta. So I've been to theaters big and small. Mm-hmm. I lived in California, where routinely within 2 miles, I could see any movie that ever came out. In Kansas City, my wife and I were bored one night, and we said, hey, let's go see this movie called, now I forgot of it, the kid, the Utah kid with the afro.
Eraserhead?
No. No, the comedy.
Napoleon Dynamite.
And the only place... The only place you could see that is in the small independent theaters. And I know that Do the Right Thing, while it probably had a good release, was not in a mainstream theater.
No, probably not.
And I guarantee you.
Napoleon Dynamite as done by David Lynch.
Well, no, think about it. That is a Eraserhead.
It is.
It absolutely is.
I would bet money Do the Right Thing never played here.
Oh, jeez, no.
Probably not.
In Hayes.
It played in Salina.
Probably played in Salina, but not Hayes.
No.
Well, Hayes didn't have but two theaters back then.
Yeah, four screens. Four screens. You had two at the mall. You had two at the Fox. Upstairs, downstairs.
Oh, well, the mall wasn't there yet.
Yeah, it was.
No, they invented the mall.
No. Matthew's wrong. He's remembering wrong.
I have sandwiches. Read of it in stories.
Too many sandwiches.
The mall.
Speaking of sandwiches and reflections on visual things, let us take this quick break and give a shout out to some people, and then we'll get back to the visual elements of Do the Right Thing.
Some people shout outs, yeah. Some people shout outs, yeah. And I am vamping because when my computer crashed, it closed my script. But now the vamping is over. And we thank Benjamin Wixer, Kevin Hall, Sean Krause, Joel Maroney, Michael Kaiser, Ethan Boy, Ramiro Barrera Palma, Jimmy Dunn, Douglas Hopkins, and Ahmed Abed El Aziz. Sorry, I used to be a news anchor. And I would like a Jimmy Chunga.
Senior love doctor, you are not.
I am not. But you know what? Nobody knew I was vamping until I sang that I was vamping.
Thank you, everyone, who contributed to the Major Spoilers cause. And if you want to find out more about that, head over to MajorSpoilers.com. More information right there at the top of the page. We're hoping that you will help us reach our goal so we can bring more Zach on Film to you.
I was going to do a whole shout-out thing, but I know that I am not Samuel Jackson. I would never be able to be Samuel L. Jackson. We love Roll Call, y'all! Does not happen that way.
All right.
I apologize.
Visual elements. The visual. Now the technical. What do you notice about the visual storytelling elements in Do the Right Thing, Zach?
We'll start with coloring.
Okay.
It's supposed to be a hot day in New York City.
Yes.
And it very much shows that throughout the pretty much every image besides probably one sequence of Demare and mother sister talking
at the very end, at night.
Where that's pretty much blue, but everything else is very much red and orange.
They went back and painted a lot of the neighborhood.
Yeah, I've read that they went
and orange to bring out that intensity.
Yeah, and I believe I think it's during the roll call when they show the three guys on the wall where they hold like heater lamps next to the camera so you can get the shimmer of the heat. And they do, I think, in one more shot with Radio Raheem.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. That's good. They're using color to emphasize the hottest day of the year. What else?
There is a lot of POV shots.
Okay.
Where they'll, like when... for instance, when Mookie Bugging Out is trying to get the people to start boycotting Sal's, he's walking over to those three guys and you're kind of tracking along with him. And the camera just does like a simple kind of move into where Bugging Out would stand. And then you go to those guys and it's like they're actually talking to Bugging Out and you're looking at it as Bugging Out.
Okay.
And I think it does one more time when Radio Raheem does his love hate thing where it's on Mookie and
totally
those two, and it goes
into
Mookie's point of view.
Did you notice that, you know, when you're looking at the lens types, and this is something that really kind of stood out, especially compared to Fast Times at Ridgemont High and The Breakfast Club, use of very wide angle lenses and wide angle lenses in tight spaces so that you get this shot of Sal, you don't get a lot of distortion in the image, but you can tell it's a very wide shot, very close, because you're seeing a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And then that gives you room to allow other characters to lean in and do things. Places like where Pino is leaning in and kind of there is a reminder that, hey, I still hate you, Mookie, when Sal is talking to him. Or just when people are having conversations with one another. You use that. It's really weird to see. Because you're using probably, I don't know, Rodrigo, a 24-millimeter lens or something like that, and you're putting it 3 feet away or a foot away from the person's face, and you're not getting the barrel distortion that you'd normally see, but you can tell that you're getting some warping going on and that you're looking at this in a very different perspective view of the world.
Yeah.
The other thing is the use of a Dutch angle.
Yes.
Rodrigo, what's a Dutch angle?
A Dutch angle is... it's like a Dutch oven, except
you hold
the blanket down. Yes,
I know. Oh, Mr. Cotter, pick me. I know.
Let's see. Who else could I ask about? Matthew, tell us about a Dutch angle.
A Dutch angle is what I like to refer to as Twilight Zone filming, where your camera is tilted so that it's not vertical to the horizon of what you're looking at.
Perpendicular to the horizon.
It's not like it sets your actual framing off kilter, which gives you the impression that the things that are about to happen are not quite right. If you've ever seen the Twilight Zone episode Third from the Sun, every single shot in the episode for 26 minutes is at a Dutch angle.
So were those.
And you find out at the end, you get that big twist at the end, we're headed for a new planet. It is called Earth. Dun, dun, dun.
Oh, okay.
And like every shot in Thor on Earth is almost a Dutch angle.
Yeah, to an extent. I mean, if you watch the 1966 Batman series, every time that you're fighting a villain, everything's at that Dutch. Now, there's extreme measures of Dutch. I mean, you see this in car commercial where you Dutch the camera and you get that power left to right shot of the car zooming through the scene. And that's power, right? You see that in, I said, the 1966 Batman. There's a real fascinating use of the Dutch angle in Hook from Steven Spielberg, a movie that I totally detest. But there's a scene where Dustin Hoffman as Hook is walking through his cabin and the ship is tilting left and right like it's on the water. But the camera dutches in the opposite angle each time that Dustin Hoffman takes a step and is having a conversation where he is torn between, do I go and kill this boy or do I just leave the things the way they are? And in Do the Right Thing, we see a slight Dutch. It's not an extreme Dutch angle. It is a slight. And we're talking about 10, 15 degrees just to show you that and to build that tension to say, hey, conflict is coming up. And that's typically when you use a Dutch angle is when there's conflict.
Yeah.
If you want to see another really great one, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, the original silent film version, which I think may be kind of the example because the Dutch in this actually means Deutsch, German, and it's a German expression.
Das Deutsch Deutsch Angle?
Das Deutsch Angle. But yeah, and it's a really simple trick, and a lot of people who aren't necessarily as aware of camera movements will be influenced by that.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh yeah.
If you want to see a puke-worthy example, watch if you want to see a puke-worthy movie, but an example
Hook?
Of that.
I already talked about Hook, Rodrigo.
Well, Battlefield Earth.
Oh, I haven't seen that yet.
I've seen it.
Entirely.
I am not speaking to you any longer.
It is entirely shot at a canted angle. Like every time anything happens, the camera is like at a 45 degree angle.
Oh. That's pretty extreme.
Yeah, it's extreme. Ridiculous. And for no reason. Like, there it doesn't really, you know, give you like, oh, this is a perspective change or this is happening because this is happening. It's like, no, it's like literally they're using it to build tension where there is none, assuming there is an explanation and not just like, oh, wow, we forgot to calibrate our tripod.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yes, I get to see a lot of Dutch angles, and the students don't even know they're doing the Dutch angle.
Exactly.
they didn't do it on purpose.
Heck, I've shot plenty of stuff in a Dutch angle just because I'm out on the field and I forgot to set my tripod.
Yeah, everything that I see at a Dutch angle gives me that feeling of but it's especially awesome when it's unintentional and you're watching like an interview with somebody about the opening of a pizza place and the angle is there and you're like it's wonderful.
You know, we've talked before, Zach, in class about camera placement in relation to who has power in the scene, right? If you're shooting down on someone, the person you're shooting down on has less power than you're shooting up on someone. There's a great scene in the movie where Buggin' Out is on the sidewalk and the biker guy, the Celtics t-shirt guy, comes walking by and scuffs his shoes. And there's a great exchange where Buggin' Out goes and confronts him on the doorstep, the stoop of his apartment. And during that conversation, you may want to go back and watch this again. Buggin' Out is shot from below, looking up towards him, because he's saying, you're lucky that I'm the righteous man and I'm not going to fight you and I'm not going to, beat you or, take any violent actions against you. You cut to a close up of the biker guy, and I forget what his name is, slight Dutch angle, but also shot from slightly above looking down so that you show that he is in this power of he's not in power.
Right.
But as the conversation goes on and the Celtics biker guy starts to talk back, suddenly, especially right at the end of the movie where he goes up the steps and he's standing up at the top of the steps, And I read one essay where it's like he's essentially ascending up. But he turns back and says, I was born in Brooklyn. Suddenly at that point, you're shooting down on Buggin' Out and all the other kids, and you're shooting up on him. That's the only time that that happens. And again, people are pointing out, here's Spike Lee again talking about race relations through the use of the camera placement and the camera angle in how these characters are dealing with one another.
Yeah.
Do you see some other things like that being used, a camera placement, camera angle to affect?
Yeah, that sequence is a really good example of the placement. What are other ones? I think it's Demare's on the steps and the four kids come and start kind of harassing him.
Oh, right.
I think it does the same thing where it shoots. It starts out shooting Demare from above and you're looking down on him. Mm-hmm. And then it starts explaining.
Yeah, why they don't believe in him.
Why they don't believe him. And it starts getting back underneath him a little bit. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure it does it there.
Well, they do the same thing when he's talking to Sister Mother, where even though he's looking up at her,
right,
there's still the angle is a lot down on him looking up and having that conversation. Same way that he's a lot more in control than what I think people are giving him credit
towards,
for.
Even though the nighttime sequence.
End. Yeah.
Yeah, because they're shooting up because then you see the nightlight come on, the street light come on. Mm-hmm.
Anything else you want to add, Rodrigo or Matthew, about the cinematography?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of camera movement.
Oh yeah, yeah. Yes.
In this, a lot of the time you get this, and I believe they're crane shots of Mookie walking down the street. And you see a lot of moving shots of the street, either kind of parallel or down
on
the ground.
Yeah, down the middle of the street.
Down the middle of the street. And you can read any number of things into it, but you know, if nothing else, it makes for, you know, these shots where he's walking down the street to show you what the neighborhood is like, you know, kind of that life of the neighborhood, that people are walking around, that people you have met or will soon meet are in that same space. Those moving shots really help to accomplish to give you that sense, and also to give you the sense of pretty much exactly how big this neighborhood is, which is to say not very big.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Now, there's
those moving shots. You can see, you can see from Sal's pizzeria to Mookie's house and how far that is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just like three doors down.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I'm over at the IMDb and I'm looking at the poster, the iconic poster that everyone remembers. Mookie and Sal looking up at the viewer with Do the Right Thing chalked onto the street. And, you know, for a film that really uses a lot of oranges and reds, the poster is quite different because it's primarily blue.
Yeah. It's weird.
Which is an interesting thing to think about with the color.
They do it to torture you.
Well, I suppose you could read a lot of things into that.
Yeah.
Marketing is its own thing. You know, obviously
it's kind of thing where you go and you see the trailer and it doesn't have anything to do with what's
happening. Yeah. Absolutely. We have been fooled by trailers before.
Just as a quick offset, I finally saw the movie Branded, not what the trailer led you to believe.
Yeah.
What do you do if you're branded?
Yeah. So go ahead with your discussion.
Oh, sure. Anything? I mean, it's just that, that's a great example of you go do the right thing. They were like, what is going to look good? We need like the two central characters and let's put in this blue sidewalk so that the actual logo of the movie, that is in fact the logo that we see on screen, pops because it's yellow. Right. If they had put it up against orange, it would not pop.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm guessing the blue choice is that they just want the, you know, that pretty iconic font.
Yeah. Well, but it's also
the right thing to be there.
Blue is also calming, right?
Right.
And so it's in a way misleading you into thinking what's going to happen, or it's not prepping you for what's going to happen, as opposed to what's that movie, Watch Washington Burn, or whatever that new movie that's out.
And that's
where you can look at it, you can see Washington's on fire. Okay, I can tell from the poster exactly what's going to happen.
The movie might have actually been called Washington's on Fire.
Maybe it is.
But it also gives you, if you look at it, you're looking down at both of the characters, but there's also the point. You'll notice Sal is situated higher. And I don't know if that has, you know, if that has anything specific to say when we're looking at, we were just talking about the cinematography. You look like, you know, Mookie seems to be down and out and Sal is up with his arms crossed. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think it's a cool poster.
Yeah, it is. Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. So,
and you know, if we're going to talk about advertisement, I mean, to this day, if you watch a trailer for Do the Right Thing, there's a deliberate, you know, a deliberate theme of not telling you what actually ends up happening.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Nowadays, in a lot of trailers, eventually the entire movie is spoiled.
Well, I mean, even the opening credits of the movie itself, where you've got Rosie Perez dancing in a variety of different outfits and a variety of different colors, you're watching that and you're like, I have no idea what this is about. I'm fascinated.
What is this movie about?
I don't know, but is she going to keep dancing?
Yeah.
Because as long as she keeps dancing.
I'm watching. Zach, what about editing?
Oh, editing. They smashed the crap out of some of those conversations.
Oh, yeah.
Where they just piled dialogue right on top of each other to create just especially with arguments, they're just cutting quickly between each other, and they're talking over each other, and it's very chaotic.
Well, it creates tension, it creates a lot of interest, action in scenes where there really isn't a lot of action, you know, where the mayor stops Mookie. Doctor, you know, I want to talk to you. And it's like, what? And it's back and forth, quick. And it's a conversation that really doesn't have a lot of action to it, but because of the way it's cut, you can create that tension throughout there. And especially go back and watch that scene with the Celtics biker guy again and see how well that's edited. So well. I mean, there's almost no breath in between where one person ends and the next person begins the dialogue. So we are running really long on time. Rodrigo, final thoughts?
Final thoughts. Do the Right Thing is a movie that accomplishes a lot with very simple techniques. You know, through editing, we see inside of people's heads, you know, that scene where everybody's shouting out racial slurs. That's editing. But also through editing and the camera angle, we see that they are not literally standing there insulting each other. That's all in their heads. And we get that. You know, conversations where the camera slides into where Mookie is and things like that to see things from his point of view. Compounded with a lot of quick cuts and a lot of intensity gives us a movie that builds a lot of tension out of really very few events. And that's the real mastery of Do the Right Thing. Is it's a movie where one thing happens, but it's explosive because the entire movie, through techniques and through character interactions, builds a ton of tension.
I like this movie because it is Spike Lee making a comment on his view of race relations and the problems with race relations, and using every frame of the film to push his message out to people, to make people more aware. And yes, the characters may be flat and two-dimensional in their portrayal, but each one serves an important role in how the story is told. But every word, every shot, every angle, every edit, I think is just wonderful in this film, and a lot can be learned from it. Mm-hmm. Matthew?
I agree. And I think that if you're watching this particular movie, you can't help but appreciate the technique employed and the point of view that the director puts into it. This is a movie where a lot of times the characters are yelling directly at me because they're yelling at each other, and I'm in the position where I am the camera eye point of view. That really brings you into the tense, horrible, hot, oppressive day, and it puts you really – it makes it very immediate, very real, and this is one where – I would say definitely go see it. A lot of times people say, oh, this movie is all about the hitting you over the head with the message. No, this movie has message. It actually has multiple messages. But it doesn't hit you with them so much as it forces you to look at them.
And you're right.
And then say, okay.
And that's absolutely true, because here's the thing. I am not from around here.
What?
You know, I mean, I've...
You're from Ohio, right?
Yes, I'm from the far-off land of Ohio. No, I mean, I'm not... I didn't grow up in the United States, so, you know, my point of view on this is going to be different. You know, they say that only... white people ask if you did the right thing. You know, when I was looking at this the first time, I was like, oh, I see. The movie leaves it open as to whether he did the right thing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Then we see the thing by Malcolm X, and it's at the very end where it's just a speech by Malcolm X. It's like, oh, okay, so the movie's telling you that he didn't, or that he did do the right thing. And then they roll in that thing by Martin Luther King, and it's like, oh, wait, no, we're back to not telling you whether he did the right thing mm-hmm. or not. They're just contextualizing it. Yeah. All right, I see what you're doing. Okay.
Yep, that's what I was just going to say. So yeah. Great. And yeah, and that does leave everything open-ended. So now, final question, Zach.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn from this movie? And more importantly, what techniques or what are you going to be able to take with you going forward?
Oh, well, there's so many. Why is there ticking?
I hear no ticking.
This is a time dancer. I am not a jerk. I'm a putz.
Got it.
Get it straight, mister.
It's not my first language.
Yeah, it's good. Not mine either.
How important camera placement is and framing and just how you set up the camera is important from visually, but also from a storytelling aspect to show what's happening, but then continually build like tension through how it is. Editing. Just getting people into it. And then also music editing, because this was freaking loud movie.
Oh, yeah.
And it's so loud that the music will overpower anything characters are saying sometimes. And so that builds a tension and like disorientation through the listener, and it really gets you into those fights of people yelling inside of Sal's.
Mm-hmm.
That was wonderful to see. Even the small things like painting, well, not really, it wasn't really a small thing, but the painting of the neighborhood to make it seem hot. The clothing of Mookie
mm-hmm.
signified a break in the movie, and I've switched tones really from what Mookie was doing from the beginning to the end. I don't know, just you can watch this movie probably 15 times and you can learn 15 new different things about storytelling.
Yeah. And that's one of the things is that you can get in it. There's a lot of messages that you can dissect this on a number of different levels and go dive down deep into this and find out, you know, all these different things. So that's good. I'm going to give you an A this time, Zach, because you did do your homework. And I know you did your homework because off show, you were talking about things that you've done and researched. And I think you've got a good grasp on this. So this week, I am giving you a gold star.
Woohoo.
Matthew?
I agree. I'm going to go with a B+. What? A B+ is very good. It's like an above average rating. But most importantly, it's something where Zach pointed out a couple of things that I had never considered about this movie. And that's pretty awesome, you know, considering, again, I think it was in a previous MSP. I said that there's nothing wrong with not knowing things as long as you're willing to learn. And I think that Do the Right Thing taught him a little bit of that lesson, and he has learned his lesson well.
And Rodrigo.
Zach definitely approached this movie with a critical eye. He gets a pass from me.
Excellent. Rodrigo grades on a pass fail.
I do. I'm just strictly pass fail.
He hates the curve.
And I think Rodrigo made the good comment. You're viewing this film with a critical eye.
Yeah.
Always got to ask this question too. Did your girlfriend watch it?
After I watched it once, I was going to go back and watch it again. I said she had to watch it with me, and she made it about 25 minutes through and fell asleep, and I got upset, and I told her today, I am buying the Blu-ray. And we will watch this, and then we will discuss it afterwards.
She fell asleep, and he threw a trash can through her window and screamed, "Hey!"
Yeah. Didn't get to thank God for the forehead, thank God for the chin. She didn't make it that far.
She did not make it that far.
All right. Do you watch these movies at 3 in the morning? Is that why she's always falling asleep, or does she...
Well, I watched this one at a weird time. Things?
Oh, okay.
Something got canceled that I had to go to, and so it's like, well, I still need to watch this, so... I pulled up on Amazon and started streaming it.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. Just asking. We're going to have to bring her in one of these days and See if she's actually watched one of these
movies. Sex girlfriend on film.
It will get 21st 25 minutes of the movie.
Getting dumped.
How did you feel about the
Zach
first 10 minutes?
Zach is single.
All right, good job, Zach. That's what we want you to do. We want you to be able to view these films through a critical eye. And I'm going to give you a choice then, since you did so well this time.
Woohoo!
We can either watch next time what I had planned, because Rodrigo had made a comment about, can we please get out of the 80s?
Yeah, right before he's like, I love this movie from the 80s.
We can either go back, way back and watch the movie M, or we can watch The Conversation.
Mercy!
Quiet, don't ruin the ending. And I'll tell you what, one will probably deeply bother you.
Yeah.
The other one will, the other one will disturb you. Mm-hmm.
They will both tweak your melon.
Yes. So no matter what, it's a loss for you.
Yeah. And your maybe. Girlfriend will not watch them with
No, you. She won't watch either one. I guarantee you she'll get 5 minutes into M, which is a German film. And subtitled, but it is so good. Rodrigo and I've actually talked about this movie before on the Major Spoilers podcast. Oh, Matthew too.
It popped up, I believe, in a top five.
Yeah. And you'll get to the point where you'll actually watch those subtitles and they'll disappear if you get that involved in the movie.
Oh yeah.
So
your brain will disappear.
You will automatically learn German just to watch it.
Let's go with M.
Okay. M. Yeah. 1939, right? Is that what it is?
1931.
1931. Peter Lorre. And great role. It's disturbing, Zach.
I'm ready.
Still do your homework, though.
Do my best.
Zach on film.
All right, that's going to wrap it up here for another week on Zach on Film. Make sure to head on over to majorspoilers.com to give any thoughts you have on Do the Right Thing. And make sure while you're there to click on the Amazon link on the homepage where you can head over to Amazon and pick up your very own copy of Do the Right Thing, much like I'm going to do. The price will cost exactly the same for you, but a little bit of that will come right back to us to keep these wonderful shows going for you to enjoy wherever you may be in future or possibly past if time invention becomes a thing. So that's going to wrap it up here. Make sure to come back next week as we talk more great films.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.